I was working at a venture-backed startup in downtown Manhattan, and I was one of the only women. I was the only pregnant person, and I looked around in tech and I said, where are the women talking about what pregnancy is really like? Where are the family people? Is startup culture just hustle and grind with no mention of kids?
I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Dan Smolin Podcast. We help people to navigate the future of work, to work that is profound, protects the planet, empowers people and communities, and is fun to do, meaningful work. The stories that our guests tell and the insights that they provide will inspire you to connect with work and experiences that stoke your passions and make the world a better place. For the future of work is meaningful work. The mission of the Dan Smolin Experience is to help people find success and enjoyment in the work that they do and hope to do. We believe there are four career journey components that get people to blissful work and career experiences. And they are dream, explore, strategize, and act. First, we encourage people of all ages, backgrounds, and levels of education and training to dream about the kind of work that they believe will make them happy and well-purposed. Next, we guide them to explore opportunities to do the work that they dream about. Then, we focus them to strategize, to align with the skill and experience needed to do the work and opportunities of their choosing. And last, we prod them to act, to seize on the opportunities to do the work of their dreams. We believe the key to success is intentionality, allowing dreams, explorations, strategies, and actions to happen fluidly. To be truly successful in the future of work, we must be career intentional about dreaming, exploring, strategizing, and acting throughout our lives. You can find useful and actionable resources on dansmolin.com. And when on the site, make sure you sign up for our free newsletter. Just click the newsletter tab on the top of our webpage, click subscribe, and you will be on your way. In a dynamic future of work, agility is key, and our ever-changing dreams can help us to align with future success. This week, we meet Sarah K. Peck. She is the CEO and founder of Startup Parent and host of the popular Startup Parent podcast. As a former startup executive and mom to two young kids, Sarah is leading the charge to make startup business environments become as innovative in workplace culture as they are in technological advancement. We cover a lot of ground in this episode, including Sarah's own professional and parental journey, the difficulties and harsh realities of startup life on working parents, and her thoughts on how to make startups more inclusive places to work. I spoke with Sarah K. Peck in November 2021 over Zoom. Sarah K. Peck, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited to dig in.
And I am excited to have you here, my friend. Thank you so much. So let's get started. You are the founder of Startup Parent. What is that, and how would you describe its unique value to people?
I started a company 4 years ago, Startup Parent. We're 4 years in, and it's a company for working parents who are navigating both a business or entrepreneurial life and a family life at the same time. These are two incredibly hard challenges, and something I hear from people over and over again is that entrepreneurship is super lonely. leadership can be really lonely, and parenting feels like a complete cluster. I won't swear, but a lot of parents tell me that it's really hard. And especially in parenting, you can feel overwhelmed and like you have no idea how to be good at parenting. It just feels like a scramble. So we bring people together to talk about how difficult it is, to be honest about it, to figure out new ways of working, to go against the grain, to kind of resist hustle culture, and to really, really examine this life that we're living and how we can land somewhere between making it through and doing it really well. Aspirationally, we want to do great, but sometimes it's just about making it through. So our product, for those of you who are like, yeah, but what does your business actually do, is we have a leadership incubator for high achieving executive women. And we bring anywhere between 50 and 100 women together every year to learn from each other and lean on each other. And it's been amazing. We've run it for 4 years. And then we also have some books and of course our podcast.
Well, I want to get into the why of Startup Parent more deeply, but before I do that, I was wondering if you could take us into your own career journey, which feels like two separate important parts. You were a high-flying executive for a VC-funded startup, and your other part, or another part, establishes you as kind of a chief corporate storyteller. So I was wondering if those experiences factored into you founding Startup Parent.
That's such an interesting question. And I like to think about the work that I do as connecting the dots. My personal mission statement is I help connect people to each other, to new ideas, and to themselves. And so I look for, where is it that we're not telling the truth? Where are the stories not lining up? Like, where is it in the world that things don't make sense to me? So if you go way back, I have degrees in psychology and architecture. And while I was at an architecture firm, I realized that 90% of the work of an architect and a landscape architect is to dream up a future that doesn't yet exist. We're building new buildings. We're building new things. We're designing a new way to live. And when you design something new, part of your charter is to explain it to someone. Here's how it's going to work. Here's what it's going to look like. I need your buy-in. We've got to get on the same page. Do we agree that this fence looks the way that we think it looks, or this wall, or this component? And I saw the unique challenge of how hard it is to get people on the same page. Like, if I were to tell you, Dan, let's go camping. Mm-hmm. And in your head, you say, great. And you have this picture of like a beautiful, shiny RV, and we're going to this luxury cabin. Mm-hmm. And I've got like my backpacking tent and, you know, 2 pounds of total food gear. We have a very different idea of what camping is. We can really mess up in communicating to each other. So where I started my career is not where I have landed in the middle of it at all. Mm. I left the company to help people tell stories. So that's the chief corporate storyteller. I worked with CEOs and other leaders to listen to them and then translate their ideas into words and stories. And then when I got to Startup Parent specifically, I was working at a venture-backed startup in downtown Manhattan, and I was one of the only women. I was the only pregnant person, and I looked around in tech and I said, where are the women talking about what pregnancy is really like? Where are the family people? Is startup culture just hustle and grind with no mention of kids? Kind of propelled me onto this journey, this curiosity journey of, wait a second, this can't be all that it is. Like, where are the stories? What's not being said? That inquiry led me to creating Startup Parent.
This is so interesting. You described in pre-interview the life of working at a startup as, and I love this word, frenetic. It says it all. And you also said that at companies that are founded to innovate, the one thing that they don't do is innovate their culture of work. So dig deeper into this, Sarah. What happens to executives in these hard-charging alpha cultures, if you will, where people, you know, they have lives like you do, and you know, our parents and our caregivers, you know, they have lives outside the building, but then the culture expects them to be hard-driving, in the building, ever present, 24 hours a day. that's a bit hyperbolic, but it just feels that way. What are your thoughts?
Oh, you nailed it. I think work culture more generally is incredibly intense. And if you look at the scope creep of the last 30 or 40 years, we have gone from maybe 8 to 5 or 9 to 5, now to 9 to 6, 8 to 6. Now people are starting to check their email at 6 a.m. to get a head start on the day, or they do it on Sunday night to get a head start on their week, and they're working into the evenings. And if you look more truthfully at what people are doing, especially in the knowledge worker economy, people are working 60 to 70 hours instead of 30 or 40, and we are working incredible amounts of time. Now, that would be okay if salaries were commensurate with actual input. But I think that workplaces are extractive, and we take employees and we try to get every inch out of them to maximize profits. And you probably know more about this than I do, about the laws that shifted towards maximizing shareholder value and the different employee protections there are. But the person who is part of the labor force is also a human that has a life. And applying work as the only way to have a life is really, I think, deeply sad and deeply toxic. I really struggle with work at all costs, because there are so many more interesting things and relevant things and complementary things that are important for our lives.
If talent are, as I hope they would be, the most important part of a company, then you're going to value your talent regardless of gender, sexual orientation, of background, of spheres of influence, whatever, because if you are honoring them all, you're going to have better products, you're going to have better services. You may even gain market share and have greater ROI. And yet, this culture that you were in, I hate the term, but it really is a bro culture. Why? Because bros don't typically take care of families, raise kids. And that has to hurt. I'll go to the C-suite on this. That so many C-suites allow this doesn't make sense from a business standpoint. How are you going to create products that benefit the most people if your talent pool doesn't reflect America or the world?
100%. I think this is so important. And I think we're also coasting on a 20 or 30 year surplus of talent, right? It wasn't as competitive. And we're seeing a real shift in the time of the pandemic and the Great Resignation. People are getting pickier about the type of work they do. And employers are having a lot more difficulty hiring. And it's like, oh, wait a second, supply and demand actually works here. I find that startup culture is very intense, but it's also, I want to call it what it is. And I hope people listening really take this to heart and think about it. I think it's lazy thinking. I think that expecting people to work at all times of day, at any time, to jump when you say jump, what that tells me is there's a lack of strategic direction and a lack of boundary setting from the people at the top. That means, hey, you know what? We just want to hire people that can do everything and do it all and do it whenever I say. And I think that's a toxic thing to do. I don't love the word toxic because sometimes it gets overused. But if you are building your business on the back of what Bridget Schulte and others have called the ideal worker, the ideal worker is usually a man or a male who is single or unattached, or if they're married, they have a wife at home taking care of the home life. So they have no obligation or responsibility to other people, which leaves them free to work early in the morning, to go to happy hours in the evening, to go on weekend business trips. Like, their work is allowed to be the most important thing in their life. That is a choice that people can make. But it comes on the backs of other people. It requires nannies, stay-at-home wives. It requires not being married. And there's so many men that wake up at 55 or 65 and say, hey, you know what? I actually, like, my health is destroyed and I'm not in a loving relationship. And I really wish I had had time for that too. Like, this maybe isn't all that it's cracked up to be. So I don't know. I really struggle with it, because I think the alternative is making hard decisions. And that's part of the role of being a leader. You have to make tough decisions. And some of those tough decisions that you make are, hey, we are going to work from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Or we're going to have a flexible space to work, but we are going to come in twice a week. The rest is remote. You have to get really clear about what exactly you're trying to do and why you're doing it the way you're doing it. And I think critically, who gets left out because of your decisions and choices? If we're not willing to examine that, we're going to default to the culture around us and we're going to default to the easiest first decision, which is, you know what? I just want someone who's available at all times because I haven't, you know, made a strategy and I'm just going to say jump. It also blocks you from talent. When you systematically decide that people who have other things outside of work, like childcare responsibilities, parenting duties, maybe they're female, you cut your talent pool by 50, 60, 70%, and you won't eventually be the most innovative company because you have restricted yourself from the outset.
Well, you said a lot of interesting things. I'm going to try to tick off a few of them. One is this idea that more hours work means more productivity and more success. That could not be farther from the truth, I think, because I was that exec once. I worked in advertising as somebody in their late 20s. I had had a lot of early success, and I followed this notion that others felt that I had to do, which was to work, and I hate to admit it, oftentimes up to 80 hours a week. That deprived me of time with my wife. I didn't have a family yet, but the effect on my health and ultimately on my ability as an executive was unbelievably bad. So I agree with everything you're saying here. And it's made me wonder too, Sarah, why entrepreneurial ecosystems like startups, which are all about breaking things and figuring out new ways of creating value, are so old school when it comes to their own tribes, if you will, that they're doing all the right things in terms of breaking stuff and trying to create opportunities. And yet the biggest thing that needs to be broken is this Paleolithic culture that permeates so many companies. And I understand why. You know, 40 years ago, a lot of these changes came to being. Shareholder value became very, very important, if in fact more important than employee earning power, to the point where it was more important to have an equities portfolio than it was to earn a living. That's crazy. And it's crazy because it cuts out this wide swath of a talent pool that isn't necessarily going to be an executive. So I'm wondering how you think you as a leader, as the leader of Startup Parent, can change the narrative so we get to a better place so that parents can be loving, involved parents who have great lives that include work and not lives that are mostly work or almost entirely work?
This is such a good question. I love this idea too. One of our core values at Startup Parent is we don't have to do things the way they've always been done. So I get that plastered on mugs and t-shirts and we send it out to everyone. We've got postcards. We don't have to do things the way they've always been done. And what that means is there is usually a dominant story out there, but it's not the only story. And so this startup bro culture, which is frenetic, we see unicorns, we see billion-dollar companies, we see the tech giants, and we hear the stories of the college dropouts, of living in garages, of coding all night long and making it happen through brute force, through all the time and the labor intensity that you put into it. But if you look a little closer, that's not the only story of successful startups. And we tend to gloss over those or not look at those. So one of my jobs is to tell the other stories. I want to tell the untold stories or make those stories a little more popular. Because alongside these big companies, they're 80 to 90% of businesses out there are people who are building regular businesses, maybe building them to 5 million, 10 million, 50 million, but they're not getting massive coverage and they're maybe not in the Fortune 500. But there's so many people out there who are actually doing this already. And I've interviewed many of them on my podcast, and one person said, She's a parent. She's built 3 companies. She sold 2 of them already. And she said, you know, if I have 80 hours of work to do this week and I look at it, I spread it out. So I do 40 this week. Mm. Who's telling me I have to go faster, right? I can go slower as long as it pencils out on paper. We don't have to do it as fast. So I'm with you. I mean, we like doing things at breakneck speed and trying to like disrupt and do everything super, super fast. That is one way of doing things, but it's not the only way that works. It also is not necessarily the best thing to borrow against. Not to say like, hey, because they're doing it this way, I should do it this way. Your business might be totally different.
I've only had one experience of trying to be a startup. I had invented a process which ended up getting a patent, and that patent never got used by me, but I sold it for a lot of money to a marketing concern, and they're using it now. But what I remember about that, Sarah, was I learned that the first question, at least then, that a startup entrepreneur asks is, or has to answer is, what's your exit strategy? And of course, the exit strategy is I'll cash out, I'll have my stock, I'll sell to a bigger company, I'll become a billionaire. Okay, great. But when so much of the continuum is based on scale and on share price and PE ratios and stuff like this, and the equation doesn't include people, all these things you're talking about are absolutely guaranteed to happen. Burnout, bro culture, and maybe you get to your goal. Maybe you are, you know, you roll the dice and your little startup, you know, hits all the right marks. You got a lot of friends and family to fund you. You got an angel investor who supported you, or perhaps several. You then went through several rounds of VC, and lo and behold, you go through an IPO and all this stuff. I like the fact that you're looking at companies that may be going on that continuum, but they have a people first value set, which is to say, we're going to all do this here, but not at the expense of our health and our sanity. So Who's out there that's doing it right? You mentioned you're talking to a few of them or you're watching a few of them. Are there companies out there that you really like? Or if you can't name them, can you describe what they're doing?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that you just brought up that's so important is that a lot of this pressure comes from investors. So a lot of this is part of the VC world. If you're looking for outside money, they're looking for you to build it as fast as possible because they want a quick or as quick as they can get return on their investment. There's really interesting stuff out there about people who are bootstrapping at a slower pace because they actually think it'll be more successful for them than having the huge amounts of money but not being able to manage it well, or having all that extra pressure from investors to do it a different way than they would have wanted to. I am so curious how many startups failed and fail because their founders or employees burned out, or because we lost the ability to innovate, not because they weren't able to do it. Because I tell you what, in entrepreneurship, year 4 and year 5 are some of the hardest years because you are trying to get things to stick and you're trying to find something that works and you're trying to build the flywheel. You're trying to build the marketing engine. You're trying to get traction. All of it can be so challenging. And if you aren't able to make it through the marathon that is like pushing through this, then you're going to burn out. So you asked for companies that are doing this well. I think there are a lot of companies that are out there that are really interesting. Buffer is a pretty fascinating social media tool. And they're very transparent about their organization, their operations, and they give people a dedicated time off every year. I believe it's either Buffer or Evernote that has a policy where you get a certain amount of money to take a paid vacation. They'll pay you for your vacation, but only if you don't check email once during vacation. You don't get that extra money if you log into work in any way whatsoever, which I thought was a really interesting set of incentives because we know that we're addicted to our phones and our social and our work devices. Slack is another social connector and we don't want to miss out. And so there are companies out there that say, no, not this way. I believe David Heinemeier Hansen and Jason Fried have a company where they try to stop around 35 hours a week because it's just not productive for anyone to do more beyond that point.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you there because I live that life. You know, you hit beyond 35 and 40 you're running on adrenaline, and adrenaline doesn't necessarily get you to creativity and to any kind of success. You know, one company I want to add to this, which you may or may not be familiar with, is GitLab. So
yes.
Earlier in 2021, I had Darren Murph on, who's the head of remote at GitLab. At the time, they were pre-IPO. During the fall of 2021, they went IPO and had a very good IPO. And this is a company with a 100% distributed workforce. Sid Shabrandy, who's the CEO of the company, has a people-centric view on things. And he believes in this idea that work is part of the day and not the day. So yes, there are some out there that I'm even aware of.
Yeah. And I think, so this is the space that I'm trying to occupy with the Startup Parent Podcast, is interviewing entrepreneurs that are also parenting. And Vanessa Van Edwards has been on our show a number of times. She's the best-selling author of Captivate, and she runs the Science of People, which is a behavior lab. It looks at like how to be better at doing your human behavior so we're not so awkward. And she has talked openly about what it looks like to have 6 employees and a small team and to make a really successful business also while trying to have kids. I've interviewed about 200 people right now, and I'm so impressed with so many of them. There's one more example that I think is really relevant. Her name is Shama Hyder, and she runs Zen Media. So she's all in marketing and media and social. Online, she's everywhere. She's like the Roy Kent of marketing. And for those of you who don't watch Ted Lasso, the Roy Kent reference is he's here, he's there, he's everywhere. So she's everywhere. I am so impressed with her because when I interviewed her, she said, I love working late at night. My best time to work is from 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. And I had a kid and I thought, oh no, that's going to have to stop. And then she worked it out so that her nanny comes over around 6:30 or 7 and gets the baby and does the entire early morning shift until 11. And she's like, I still work till 2 a.m. and I sleep until 11 because that's what I love. And then I see my kid for lunch. And I was like, thank you for not saying that you just hustle on no sleep, that you work till 2 and then you wake up at 6. Like, thank you for owning the fact that you sleep until 11 a.m. and you get help to support you doing that. I think that's so cool.
Well, Darren Murph, who I just mentioned to you, is a dad of a young child. He and his wife adopted a baby boy. And having this freedom to work when it's best for him aligned beautifully with the fact that his kid kept him up at night or was active at night.
Yes.
And Darren found that those overnight hours, especially with a globally distributed workforce, work perfectly.
That's amazing. I think for people who are listening, and the question is, wait, how do I do this? Like, how do I pick and sift? And what do I do about this? I know a lot of people believe in this conceptually, right? Yep, there's hustle culture. Yep, startups are tough. Yep, we're working long hours. But what do we do about this? Mm-hmm. For me, it comes down to, I want to say, hyper specificity, getting so specific about what you do, who it's for, and what it is exactly. And I'll give you an example. I used to work at this architecture firm, and in the height of globalization, we started getting more and more projects and contracts in Taiwan, Korea, Japan, China, things that were 12 hours, 15 hours away. Scheduling meetings is really challenging when working in San Francisco and you've got clients in China. So we started doing all these meetings from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. and then again, all these meetings from 6 p.m. till 9 p.m. Well, that's troubling because then you're getting in at 6 a.m. and you're not leaving till 10 p.m. That's where this broke down. And I really wish the executive leadership team had said, hey, fascinating. We're going to need some people to do 6 to 12, some people to do 10 to 6, and some people to do 4 to 10, right? We're going to need people on different shifts. Or we're going to do all of our meetings around the globe early, and we need you to be at them 2 days a week. Getting really specific about what it's for is, okay, we've got clients that need alternative time zones and we've got employees that need not to be burned out. How do we make a solution within that? Instead of just expanding scope, look at what's changing and then get really specific about it. I have another example I can go into. Do we have enough time?
Sure.
Okay, great. Awesome. The other example is in this world that we're in right now where everyone's been well, not everyone, but most people have been remote for the pandemic. People have been working from home, even making it work. And now we're at this inflection point where some people want to go back to the office and other people say, no way, Jose, like I never want to go back. We need to figure out what it's for exactly. Does the work have to be done in person? If so, what parts? If so, why? What do we lose when we're at home? What do we lose if we require everyone to come back in person? Who gets left out? And then coming up with a hybrid model that's like, hey, you know what? In order to get the social time we need to have enough serendipity and spontaneity, we're going to have 2 days in the office that are 10 to 2, Mondays and Tuesdays, or Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Those are our two core times. You're welcome to come into the office from 9 to 5, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. That's when our office hours are going to be, but the core time is 10 to 2, Tuesdays and Wednesdays. The rest is flexible remote work because we've gotten a lot of value out of that. We don't have to do all or nothing thinking. Everyone has to be back the entire time, or everyone has to be remote 100% of the time. There can be a flexible middle space if you get really specific about, hey, you know what? We do need that serendipity of in-person. And also making up a plan for what happens if you have a really talented person that can never make it in. What are you going to do then and why? It's harder work to do, but it's really important for great culture and then also for longevity, like long-term avoiding burnout.
Well, you know, a lot of bad decision-making, I believe, happens because companies have investments that are expensive. And probably the biggest expense there is commercial real estate. And I'm every day gobsmacked at the Wall Street Journal's attempt to say, well, you really need to be back in the office because you're missing out. You really need to be back in the co-location because that's where you need to be. And if you don't, then your career is going to falter. That is such crazy thinking. I understand why it's happening, but the cynical back end of it is terrible because, okay, so what you're saying to me is I've got to shape shift because you have expensive long-term leases that you have to pay for. And I think in the future of work, Sarah, the thing that we all need to be doing is asking talent that come before us to seek out opportunities is to really understand what makes them thrive and when does it happen. And you talked about overnights, you talked about breaking up the day. We need to learn how to interview so that not only is that person, if they're hired, is going to be successful, but we as a culture, as a company culture, are going to succeed. We're not quite there yet. And the reason is because the questions we asked have been asked by hiring managers of talent for the past 60, 75 years, if you will.
That's right. I think there's this component of trusting yourself that I hope everyone takes away from this because we are such sheep. I hate to say it.
Oh, we are.
Like you look around and you're like, oh, everyone goes to the office. We should go to the office. And we already paid for these offices. Well, we should get the most value out of it. Like, there's a lot of thinking, if we examine it, it's not really great thinking. We're just like, oh, well, everyone else has an open office, so that must be the best thing, right? An open office? Oh, 9 to 5 might be the best thing. And I really want people to be able to trust themselves. Like you, your brain, your body, it's not lying to you. I used to feel like my eyes were bleeding at 4:30. I was so done. The fluorescent lights, the open office, I would start to lose my voice from talking all day. I was so exhausted from it. And yet I was like, I looked around, I said, well, everyone else can make this work. What's wrong with me? Like, why can't I do this? And the truth is that it's a hyper-stimulating, exhausting environment. And I thrive with about 3 to 4 hours in the office a day. But I do so much better when I have 3 to 4 hours to be able to think deeply and be alone. Now, not everyone is like me, but now that I've found that for myself, it's really helpful. It's one of the reasons why I do more podcasts on audio only versus video, because it saves my energy. It protects it throughout the day.
Well, you got to do what's right for you. And
and
obviously it's working for you. Sarah, I got a couple more questions. I want to ask you about being a mom. You've got two young kids and you work remotely. What's a day like for you now? And how do you ensure that you get done what you need to get done from a work standpoint, from a podcasting standpoint, but also as a loving and involved mom?
Yeah, this is such a big question. And I do struggle with the question, you know, people say, how do you balance it all? How do you do it all? And if you could see my face, I would probably break into tears and be like, I just don't, right? Mm-hmm. The pandemic for the last 2 years, I've got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. And I'd be lying if I said that I've got it all figured out and I know how to do this all. It's really, really hard. And I feel like I don't have enough time to work and I don't have any like hobbies. I just started again. I have a 5-year-old and I just started a hobby again. So I've got a partner and he is also a CEO. Mm-hmm. So we're both running businesses and we're both running them from home and it is pretty intense. We are, I would say we're equal partners in the home. He maybe does 60 and I do 40. He does a little bit more than I do. He does the morning drop off and bedtime. He does all the book reading. He's just on it as a parent. He's such an amazing parent. I do all the cooking and the grocery shopping, and I schedule all of our like medical appointments and doctor's appointments. We kind of divide up the family's responsibilities. We wake up around 6:30. The kids are off to school around 8 to 8:15. I work from about 8:45 until about 4:45, but inside of that time is also when I exercise and go to therapy and catch up with my friends. Excellent. So on a good week, I have, you know, 25 to 30 hours to work. And because of the pandemic, I'm really recovering from burnout in the pandemic because we had 8 months with the kids home while we were both standing up businesses and no childcare. And that this is for another podcast, but that really broke me in a lot of ways. I have lingering like fear that the kids will be out of school again for a long time. I spent way too much time with my kids and could barely see straight. And like, I am grieving the fact that I didn't get to enjoy my kids more because I never got to leave them. So that was a really tough period. So now that I'm here in year two of the pandemic, I think the biggest challenge for me is I love my kids and I love my family, but my life is lopsided. There's 168 hours in the week and I spend 140 of them parenting and I could use more help and more support. And that's, the kids aren't vaccinated yet. So I'm still in that lopsided space. The one more thing I'll say about this, just in case any working parent out there resonates, is there's a little sense of disappointment and loss because I'm not great at parenting. It's just, there's no awards for parenting. There's no achievement marker. There's no one out there telling you you're doing a good job. Usually they're out there telling you you're a bad mom for anything you do. And I really miss ownership over my time and being able to make projects and be really satisfied in them. And I especially miss my hobbies. So I did start ukulele class a couple of weeks ago because I just needed something that wasn't work and parenting.
Excellent. Excellent.
It's a challenge. Yeah.
Well, what I think you're describing, so my perspective on this is I'm married to a veteran public school teacher who teaches gifted kids. And she talks to a lot of the moms. I meet a lot of moms. I see them out and about and I get to talk to them. And what I think has happened, and no one's really talking about this, is that parents en masse have quietly endured post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
If you've ever been through PTSD, and I'm not saying somebody who's been in a war zone, if you've had to deal with a medical emergency, a sudden loss, something goes horribly wrong in your life, the emotional and physical effects are unbearably difficult. And I think a lot of parents are going through this right now for all the reasons that you've described. If I can offer one bit of hope is that, and your children are young, I only have one and she's 20, it will get better. and you really are, I am sure, a very good parent. It may not feel that way, but your kids are in a loving home and they're trying to figure it all out, you know?
Yeah,
it's not perfect, but it will work out. This generation that your children are a part of are going to have to learn, and they will learn how to adapt to very difficult situations. And they will.
I want to just chime in and say that one of the things, the PTSD thing is real. Now, I haven't been diagnosed and I can't diagnose myself, but I do read a lot about complex PTSD, which is when it's not a single event, but it might be a long-term complicated. That's why it's called complex PTSD. And truly, things that used to take me an hour now take me 3 or 4. And some things I just have, it's like when you see a bear and you get, your adrenaline goes up. And then the next day you like open the door and you expect to see a bear and your adrenaline goes up, but there's no bear there anymore. That is real to me. And I say it here on this podcast because I almost feel unseen if we don't talk about this. And I feel gaslit by people who are okay. People, it's really hard for me to get on my own podcast and be like, here, I have all the answers to a pandemic, because that's not true. I don't, and I won't, but I can create community to talk about stuff that's true. And I hope that telling the truth and telling you like, hey, I'm still building stuff and I've got a family and it's hard, gives other people permission to be like, yeah, me too.
Well, if people tell you that they're okay, it's bullshit. Because
no one's okay.
No one's okay. No one's okay. Yeah. Go out, and I don't go out that much because I live in a part of the country where people decided they're going to stop wearing masks now because they've given up. And I have to be very careful. I've got people in my family that have pre-existing conditions, so I got to keep them safe. I got to keep myself safe. There is a sense that people are, hey, listen, 18, you know, we're now 21 months into this paradigm shift, and people are not doing well. And part of the reason they're not doing well is they've not acknowledged that they're not doing well. And what you are saying is absolutely spot on. And we have to take care of the mental health part of our health. Because as you say, things take you longer. Yes, your processing abilities suffer when you're under PTSD. I've had a few events in my life that have placed me in that part. If it gets really bad, it can affect your executive functioning. You'll forget how to do stuff. It'll come back. The key point is if you can seek out talk therapy, do it. It is fantastic and it will make your life better.
My husband and I both go to therapy every week and we have to go on different days just for billing purposes, which I find hilarious.
Right.
So we've got our dedicated therapy space, and I can't tell you, and for everyone listening, I cannot tell you how many men I'm talking to right now that are telling me I went to therapy and it is life-changing. I didn't know how much I didn't know. I didn't understand all of this. I did a podcast a couple years ago about how to go to therapy, and I wrote a long article about it, like, especially for my men friends for whom there's still so much more stigma. You know, women are cultured to be talkers, and it's harder at times for men to find the permission and the social kind of cultural support to go to therapy. And I think it's amazing and supportive. The other thing that I think is really essential is the social infrastructure around you. Like, if you're not doing well, having extra social infrastructure, for me, it's, I'm now going to CrossFit classes just so I can see other people in the morning and have some accountability around working out and going to the coffee shop just to see another human being. Those little moments have become really important in the pandemic just for me to have a cadence of, hey, here's life. We're safe. I'm getting stronger. It's a lot of work and I'm just slower than I used to be, at least for now.
It will get better. I promise you that. I have one more question to ask you, Sarah, and it revolves around my wheelhouse, which is future of work. As parents listening to this podcast consider their own career pivots, I'm wondering what key insight you can provide them so that, you know, they get to work that is part of their day. What questions should they be asking of themselves, of potential hiring managers, to make sure that whatever pivot they make gets them to a better place?
Ooh, that's so interesting. I think self-awareness is really key here. The more knowledge you have around, like, here's how I thrive, that's such a great way to start a conversation with a hiring manager or a team. Hey, I know what it takes for me to do my best work. These are the five things. What does your team do to support lots of different people doing their best work? How do you talk about boundaries? How do you give feedback? How regular is the feedback? How often are we trying new things? I would be really interested in hearing that. And I'm not afraid to get really specific when I interview to work at places. I say, so what time do you start exactly? Who gets in first? What time do they get in? When does everyone else get in? What is your lunch break like? How do your afternoons work? Who exercises? When do they exercise? I really dig into the nitty gritty because I want to see it. I don't want to hear you say some platitudes about culture. Oh, everyone can do what they want in their own time. No. Exactly what happens? And can I audit this? Can I be here for a couple of days so I actually see whether or not I can make it work here.
That is a great idea. Audit. I love that. It's like sort of like a workplace petting zoo. you want to kind of get a sense of what you're walking into. I would add another question, and it's a situational dynamic. So I'm going to make something up. And Sarah, you're the hiring manager here. Let me tee up a situation that I dealt with, and perhaps it happened within your team as well. And it has to do with stylistic conflicts. Person A is outgoing. They're in your face. Person B's more of a Gary Cooper, strong and silent type, and they kind of keep to themselves. But the fact that these two people are working in the same environment seems to create a conflict. How do you get involved in making sure that those two people coexist peacefully? I want to hear more questions like that. And
that's a good question.
Because, I mean, these are questions I used to tee up for candidates that I would put in front of a hiring manager, knowing that they had certain things going on and they wanted to make sure that whoever they brought in would help them solve problems like these and not make them worse. And I think in the future of work, we have to be asking, everybody's got to be asking more difficult questions, if you will.
Yes. I like how that question also points, it's a very specific example, so they can't dodge it. And it's asking, how do you embrace multiple divergent working styles, introverts, extroverts, verbal processors, writing processors, people who need quiet, people who need noise. And for me, it just in thinking about that question, if they don't demonstrate an understanding of divergent thinking processes, then that would be a strong no for me. And there are companies that do this really well. I know companies that they start a meeting with an agenda. The agenda gets sent out 24 hours in advance for the people who need time to think about it. Everyone comments on the doc. So that's great for all of the writing processors. Then there's a meeting, and the meeting is where you discuss it. And you discuss not the doc, but the comments on the doc. And then there's time for the like loud, noisy, boisterous kind of, what is Brené Brown calling it? Rumbling, right? Having a process that allows you to tap into each person's strength and saying, hey, for those of you that need 24 hours to think about this, for those of you that have to write, for those of you that need to, you know, get into shouting matches, we have all of those spaces here. You are welcome here is such a strong signaling. And if they're like, no, we just do writing and the only thing you can do is writing, that might not be for you.
Sarah K. Peck, this has been absolutely fascinating. And I hope we can get you back on at some future date to tell us what new things you've learned about the workplace culture that you are trying to help fix, if you will. Before we depart, I am wondering if you could point my listeners to your podcasts and your other social media.
Oh, thanks for having me. I love talking about work. I love overthinking it because I think it helps us in the future. What you're asking and what you're building here is so important, Dan. So thanks for building it.
Well, thank you.
So you can find me. I run Startup Parent. So the website, startupparent.com. And we have the Startup Parent podcast, which you don't have to be a parent to listen to. I think it's so interesting to listen to just other people's lives. So if you like listening to people's life stories and their business stories, we've got great stories on that podcast. If you identify as a woman, we run the Wise Women's Council every year. And that's our leadership incubator to come be messy together. And then also figure out how to lead from the mess, how to really empathize with yourself and say, hey, this is hard and I'm still going to build something. So that's the Wise Women's Council. It's on startupparent.com. And then I'm also on social media, not much, but startup_parent on Twitter and Instagram is where you find me.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
This was great. Thanks.
Links to Sarah K. Peck's social media are included in the show notes for this episode at dansmolin.com. Meantime, if you haven't done so, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get them, or listen to current and past episodes on our website at dansmolin.com. And please take a moment to positively rate and comment wherever you listen to the podcast, because that helps us to connect with new listeners. I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Dan Smolin Podcast. Thank you for joining us on an amazing journey to the future of work, doing meaningful work. And do remember this, our best days lie ahead. Let's connect again next week.